Good morning. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. I'm Andrew Popel, and I'm joined on the line by Chris Womersley. And it's been a few years since Chris and I last spoke about his novel Cairo. Today, though, we have a new novel to enjoy, City of Crows. And City of Crows takes us away to France. It takes us back in time. And Chris and I are going to delve and hopefully get some insights into it. Welcome back to Final Draft, Chris.
Thanks very much for having me on.
I'm excited to talk about this, particularly because of the historical era. But City of Crows, it broadly sits with historical events in France in the late 17th century. Charlotte Picot flees her village with her son following the death of her husband by the plague. They are waylaid and her son is kidnapped by traders who will sell him into servitude or worse. Charlotte is thrown into the path of Adam de Curé by seemingly mystical means, and together they embark to Paris to rescue Nicholas. That's a great setup. I read that to myself and I'm like, I want to reread that book.
Oh, that's good.
And you weave your tale around historical events and figures, particularly those who dabbled in witchcraft and sorcery. And I wondered, was it this capacity for belief and the possibility of magic that attracted you to this era?
Yeah, that was certainly a big part of it. I mean, I've had elements of the occult in sort of all my novels, really, to a sort of a really small degree. And I guess I read a little bit about the 17th century and the fact that people kind of believed a bit more thoroughly in sort of witchcraft and sorcery than perhaps most of us do today. And it seemed like a good sort of environment for me to really sort of roll up my sleeves and get my hands dirty, as it were, like really sort of invest a bit more deeply in kind of elements of the occult and magic and stuff. And so I guess with City of Crows, it's a matter of, the book's not a fantasy novel, although there's elements of the supernatural. And I guess my sort of way of telling the story is that I don't really ask the reader to believe in the supernatural so much as I ask them to believe that the characters believe in the supernatural, and therefore that's the way they kind of see how the world works.
What's it like psychologically to get yourself into that headspace of a population that were credulous to this?
Yeah, well, I was very sort of careful in writing City of Crows, actually, that I didn't treat... I think it's sort of necessary to treat... I think you always have to treat your characters with a great deal of respect and kind of love or admiration, even if they're kind of, you know, villainous, I guess, to a certain extent. And I was very careful with Charlotte and Lesage and all of the characters not to treat them as a sort of anthropological specimens, you know what I mean? Like, I think it was sort of, I mean, in reading about the period and stuff, and, you know, there's not a lot written about kind of, you know, the poor or working class or peasant class of the 17th century, but I think they're closer to us in their daily life in terms of their what they desire from the world than they are far from us, you know what I mean? Sort of like meeting a sort of a person from another continent who may look kind of on the surface incredibly different, but basically at heart they, you know, they fret about their children and they worry about, you know, what they're going to wear and what they're going to eat and stuff like that. Sort of our desires are more aligned than kind of not, I think.
I love reading books like City of Crows, but I feel like inevitably I start to look at them through a lens of our modern world. I feel like it's inevitable sometimes, especially when you read books closely. Was that something that you had in mind, or that you're happy to have City of Crows read as? Do you see reflections, or was it purely historical for you?
Oh, gee, it's actually a good question. Well, clearly I realise that the people who are reading it are 21st century readers and have a kind of particular worldview that is, at least for most of us, going to be at odds to a greater or lesser degree with kind of the way that people were viewing the world in the 17th century. But I guess it's about, I guess in terms of kind of a modern theme or whatever, the book is about people who are denied power who will use any means necessary to get it, I guess, even if it means kind of crossing to the dark side, as it were. So people who are sort of denied institutional power who kind of might take whatever means is at their disposal in order to get some sense of control over their lives, which I think is sort of what magic was largely about, or certainly kind of in that period.
Yeah, because I just found enormous resonance. And when you say the description you just gave there, I think immediately, well, that resonates politically on both sides of the spectrum. So much of that going on. I'm gonna try not to to turn this into a modern novel by proxy, but I did have a few thoughts and
sure.
questions. So I thought I don't want to start asking you them and then have you go, actually, Andrew, it's a historical novel. You're reading too deeply. But for those of us that were either blessed or subjected to postmodernism at university, it's kind of inevitably, well, didn't you know, Chris, you're the author, so you're dead and I'm allowed to just read this however I want.
Well, and that's true. That's true too. Like, I do know people who are kind of... I've kind of met authors in my time who are very protective of the way people read their novels and stuff, and I'm... sort of the opposite. I mean, clearly I want everyone to adore my work, but, you know, that's never going to happen for a start. And secondly, people just sort of bring to the table whatever, you know, the book sort of really only comes alive when a new imagination kind of takes hold of it, I guess, if you like. You know what I mean?
And so we're talking about broad historical events and characters that existed within the period, as well as characters that you've invented. Mm. Adam de Coulet, he was a magician. He was tried and convicted for heresy. Mm. He was later implicated in a plot to kill the King of France. In City of Crows, during the narrative, he adopts the name Lesage and toys with the wisdom of leaving the mystic life behind. Now, I did a little bit of reading, so I hope I've got this right, but historically, Lesage was actually considered quite vicious and remorseless. What were you looking for in reimagining this character?
Yeah, I think he was... I mean, Lesage always sort of fascinated me. And there is, you're right, there's a little kind of bits of documentation about him, and there's some trial records from sort of later on and stuff. But I think he was more... I mean, everyone sort of paints a picture of Lesage or Adam de Coulet as this sort of very unlovely to look at, but clearly he was very charismatic. He was very good at his kind of, you know, in inverted commas, magical tricks, and managed to sort of con a number of people over sort of a 10-year period pretty much in Paris. And you know, he served a bit of time in the galleys as a slave and then was released and made his way back to Paris. And I guess, you know, the villain, I mean, the basic kind of thing, I guess, in a novel or any good narrative is that the villain never thinks he or she is the villain. You know what I mean? Everyone kind of thinks they're on the side of the angels, as it were, even if they're kind of self-consciously dabbling in, you know, the dark arts, as it were, I guess. So my idea was, I mean, and in some ways I saw Lesage as a bit of a, it's almost like a junkie. Like, he kind of, you know, he gets condemned for impieties in the late 1660s, does several years as a galley slave, which would have been just absolutely horrendous. And the first thing he does, apparently, upon getting released in 1673, is sort of make his way back to Paris and hooks up with Catherine, his lover, who was sort of, you know, the most famous witch and abortionist in Paris at the time. And so he has this sort of, he's almost magnetic kind of attraction, I guess, to trying to make, in some ways, it's the way he makes money the best. So it's sort of incredibly sort of, the dark side is really irresistible to him because he, and although in his trial records he claims that he never really believed in any of the magical arts he was doing, he was only doing it in order to make money. He's also on the record as having, you know, buried a sheep's heart in Catherine's garden and laying a spell on it in order to kill Catherine's husband, but sort of got cold feet after a day or two and urged her to dig it up. So he didn't want to actually kind of kill anybody, and he didn't want to sort of... There were certain limits he didn't really want to go to. So in some ways I see him as a bit of a tragic figure, or sort of always irresistibly drawn to something he knows is kind of bad for him.
I was really interested in the juxtaposition of the heart and the mind in Adam's dual identities. I thought, before I realized the full extent of the historical side of the novel, I thought this was something that you'd crafted yourself. We have Le Coeur in his original identity and Lesage, the heart and wisdom. Did these competing sensibilities play, though, into your crafting of this world that relies on a belief in magic?
Wow, that's a good question. Yeah, look, sort of think all, most of us, and that includes kind of good characters in narrative fiction, are capable of holding opposing views at the same time. You know what I mean? Like, I think, you know, people are sort of inherently sort of complicated, and we all have kind of things that we believe that we know not to be true, but and it might in fact be contrary. You know, so I have a friend, for example, who's a really good, who's a vegetarian and very much interested in animal rights, but he loves gambling on the horses. You know what I mean? Which is of course incredibly kind of cruel sport, but it's just. You kind of, you know, and all of us, I think, manage to maintain these kind of inconsistencies in our sort of worldview and ideological worldview. But certainly, certainly Lesage or Adam de Curé, as his original name was, he feels like, in contrast to Charlotte, he feels like he is a more academic version of magic, if you like, or a more sort of scientific, in inverted commas, version of magic, whereas Charlotte is more sort of female, in inverted commas, you know, sort of peasant, sort of oral magic to an extent, where he kind of feels like he is more urban and sophisticated.
Yeah, and of course this brings us to Charlotte Picot. She's very much your protagonist along with Adam, and her search for a son drives the narrative. But she's also, if I'm correct in thinking, she's also a wholly fictional character in the novel.
Yeah, yeah. She's pretty much the only one who's entirely fictional. And sort of as I was saying before, there's not a lot written about kind of peasant folk, especially peasant women. And to a degree, you know, she's the ideal... She's the ideal protagonist for somebody who, yeah, has been denied power, and especially without a man, without a brother or a husband, she has no kind of real, you know, at one point someone sort of said to her, well, what are you going to do? You can become a maid or you can become a prostitute or, you know, a thief or something, but there's not really a lot of options open to somebody like that. So there's a sort of, the cell, as it were, that is made to her in order to kind of lure her into doing things that are probably contrary to her religious beliefs, is that she has very little other option, especially if she wants to try and find and save her son.
Yeah, I read a really strong feminist sensibility in Charlotte's emergence from her village. Then there's her education in mysticism by Madame Roland, who saves her, she's the witch of the forest, who really teaches that a witch is just a woman with power, and her exercise of that power in Paris. Were you driven to explore these power dynamics in the novel, or did they just emerge by the virtue of the character?
Yeah, they just kind of emerged. Like, I think trying to write a novel with the thematic concern uppermost is sort of putting the cart before the horse often. Like, I think it's sort of most good books, or certainly stuff that I like to read and I like to write, has a character initially who's sort of put under some sort of pressure, and they're forced to make sort of decisions, I guess. And, you know, I guess as I was looking at ways in order to make Charlotte as a character cross over to doing things that she might not normally do, there was a sort of a proto-feminist argument put to her, or it was sort of a proposition of, yeah, along the lines of, as I was just saying before, like, what else are you going to do, you know, like, and Charlotte sort of resists by saying, well, you know, I don't traffic in witchcraft, and the response is, yeah, well, what they call a witch is simply somebody with power. And, you know, it's certainly sort of true in that, and then this is 1673, so it's not long after the you know, the big period of the witch trials was sort of 1550 to 1650 pretty much, although it still kind of continued afterwards. So there's a sort of element of people who are kind of outsiders and who have no other recourse to power other than kind of using sort of supernatural or, you know, quasi-supernatural means, and its way of keeping people, you know, powerless.
And of course, the exercise and the impact of magic occupy many pivotal events in City of Crows, but much of the magic of the novel sort of seems to rely on more scientific tricks, perhaps that are not understood, as well as accurate reading and interpretation of a character's psychological state. Now, Lesage does this with shrewd deliberation. He's very much sort of trained himself inside. Charlotte, however, seems to have an innate sensitivity. And we've talked about the juxtaposition of their two different types of magic. Do you see them as sort of, or us more generally, inherently credulous beings? Do we want to believe? Or do you think, like, humanity now, we've moved away from that superstition of the 17th century?
Look, I think we are. I mean, there's still people who kind of, you know, zealously read their star signs every week in the paper, or, you know, visit tarot card readers and stuff like that. People, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of difference between the kind of mysticism of the sort of high Catholic Church, I guess, in terms of, you know, taking the host and stuff. You know, there's a sort of certain mystical elements in those sort of, you know, routines that date back kind of several hundred years and stuff. But I think we all, I don't know, like, I think we're all credulous to an extent and superstitious to a small extent. You know, sports people are famous for sort of, you know, always wearing, you know, the same colour underwear, for example, and things like that. Like, there's a certain, we sort of organise our lives along certain lines, whether they sort of be ideological or religious, and I think we're all kind of prone to sort of irrational beliefs about things, you know, as much as we kind of live in a, you know, rational, secular, scientific age, I guess. And, you know, that was a thing, one of the other things about the 17th century that interested me was, it was sort of on the cusp of that sort of period of the late Middle Age, what we kind of currently think of as a, sort of the modern era. But I think we're not. And then that's, and again, it goes back to that sort of thing of not wishing to treat the characters as anthropological specimens. Like, I think we've all got a bit of that within us to an extent, except maybe Richard Dawkins, who's a sort of ridiculous kind of rationalist. Yeah. But, yeah, like, I'm sure you have some kind of mild superstitions, as do I, you know, around certain behavior, you know, way I kind of work, for example. I like to be sort of use a certain pen and stuff. Not that I would not be able to work without it, but we all become attached to inanimate objects and invest them with a degree of power that they actually.
Yeah, I was also interested though in the way that power, however it is situated in a person, then leads to influence and control. And it made me wonder about how this reflects on our modern era, because ultimately the City of Crows works for the reader, or it worked for me, based on my relatability and my ability to reflect. And the way Adam Lesage is very much an interesting character study in this. He feels that he has duped many people. He doesn't really believe in his own tricks. But then when they're applied to him by Charlotte, and later on in the book, there's a monk preaching who seems to have a moment where he has Adam in his crosshairs, and Adam then interprets and allows both Charlotte and the monk to have power over him because of this need to believe, this need to cite power in an individual who might control us. And yeah, it got me really thinking about this modern era where we do tend to deify. Sports people are a great example. They have their superstitions, but we then deify them and want to follow them no matter what the ending.
Yeah, that's actually kind of a really good point. Like, I think we all have within us that sort of need or desire to, I don't know, or not all of us, because it's, you know, people who seek that power, but we like seek to kind of, yeah, you're right, cite power in something that's external to us, and it's a sort of a guiding force, if you like, whether it's a sort of a moral guiding force or political or ideological or indeed, of course, religious. You know, it's sort of a way of, and I don't know how to explain that other than it seems sort of inherent in our kind of human nature that we are a sort of a, we're kind of worshipful as a species, perhaps, you know what I mean? Like, we sort of, I mean, you know, except for those who are kind of, you know, the narcissists who don't seek to worship anything except, you know, but to be worshipped, I guess. But yeah, you're right. Like, it's, you know, and that's another thing that interested me about Lesage, is he sort of, or, you know, in the way that I've kind of imagined him and created him, is that he believes in magic and the supernatural, but he's sort of mildly tormented by the fact that he's never really been able to access it himself to as much as he would like, even though he kind of has made money out of his various kind of tricks, which are sleight of hand. So there's a sort of a feeling of imposter syndrome with him, I guess, as much as anything.
I am speaking with Chris Womersley about City of Crows, a fantastic historical novel set in 17th century France. And Chris, we've discussed the action of the novel. Adam and Charlotte are desperately trying to reach Paris to save Charlotte's son. And so much of the events turn on magic. And we've discussed it in great detail, but I want to probably, I guess, give you a final question more about your writing of magic, because I feel like this is something that could have really let the novel down, done another way. But what you beautifully did, or beautifully did for me, this was my reading, is you allow the reader to sit with the possibility of magic and the possibility of logic without ever, I guess, taking us too far one way or the other. And depending on the reader, that you would have lost someone if you'd said, okay, we're definitely going in one direction or the other. How was it crafting that? I guess, knife edge did you have to skirt there?
Well, it was a nightmare, frankly, having to try to... Yeah, I mean, I guess sort of one of the ways I got around that was by having a switched perspective between Charlotte and Lesage. So, you know, Charlotte believes Lesage to be perhaps a spirit that she has summoned, while Lesage believes Charlotte to be a woman with kind of power over him. So by sort of flicking back and forth between their perspectives, I was able to kind of maintain the ambiguity. But you're right, in that sense of, you know, the risk of losing readers and so forth, and it probably will lose some readers, I don't know. And I guess it sort of comes back to the thing I was saying before, that I never really ask the reader to believe in the fantastic or the supernatural necessarily, but what I needed to do was to create characters that the reader believe in the supernatural. So you sort of go along with their suspension of disbelief, if you like. So clearly I'm writing a book for a 21st century reader who probably doesn't believe in the supernatural, but I just need them to believe that the characters believe in what's happening, and therefore they can be sort of by proxy taken for a journey into a sort of a slightly more fabulous or fantastic environment where people really did genuinely believe that, you know, demonic spirits might have been, you know, walking in the woods and that spells cast might be able to kind of, you know, make someone fall in love with you or kill somebody or make somebody ill. So it's sort of a matter of kind of pushing things. I mean, I think all novels kind of push at the edge of plausibility, or all good novels, you know what I mean? That kind of, I enjoy that sense of being taken to sort of the outside limit of what is plausible, rather than sort of being safely within the kind of, you know, purely realist kind of mode, I guess.
Did you have to plot any unspoken explanations for yourself?
Not really. Like, I think you have to come down on, as an author, I sort of have to have a sense of what is really happening, even if I'm not giving away the full picture for the reader and leaving the reader to sort of make their own decisions. Because I think, you know, there's ambiguity, but then there's also kind of a real unwillingness to kind of commit on behalf of the author. And I think the author always needs to sort of know more than the reader does, or more than the characters let on, as it were.
And if you would like to know more, we are discussing City of Crows. I'm speaking with Chris Womersley. It is his latest novel set in 17th century France. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time on Final Draft to discuss what's a really fantastic historical novel, but as I think emerged in my discussion of it with you, has some really interesting resonances for the modern reader.